Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 18 for June the 16th, 2014. Put a lot of thought into this one. Some weeks I know what I'm going to talk about, and got the main point, and that makes the cast a lot easier. This week, I wasn't really sure what the central thing was going to be, because I had a couple of big ones. A famous coach passed away this last week, and I didn't know him too well personally. I didn't watch him coach. You know, someone like Tom Landry comes to mind, the famous hat, the coach of the Dallas Cowboys. That was someone that we all watched coach. And of course, you know, Vince Lombardi. Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. You know, Vince Lombardi as a coach was a bit of a swear word. It was in the era before they knew simple things like hydration, and Lombardi was someone to push it. As we see these days, people die. Football players die in practice, and they die from not being tended to, not being looked after properly, being pushed too hard. Well, imagine what it was like under Lombardi. Yeah, he was a bit of a meanie. Maybe that was how he chose his players, was who could put up with the most abuse. Chuck Knoll seems to be indifferent. I do have some quotes from him. I'll get to him later. Partly because he was a downer, someone passing away, I wanted to not start with that. Even though it seems like I've started with him. The person I want to start with is Rick Riley. Rick Riley is a famous writer, sports writer, done it for decades. And he's hung up his pen. This past week he posted his final column. And then there was a tribute column. And it wasn't featured in its own right that I could see. It was just a link off of his final column. We asked people from the sports world what story in Rick Riley's 36-year writing career they remembered the most and why. And that was really good. Because first of all, these people are telling you really good Rick articles. Really good opinion pieces that Rick did. And so then you can go and you can read those and you can get something out of those individually. But then it also gives you insight into the people. The range of people from the range of sports. The range of stories that Rick did. The reasons why people liked him, the diverse reasons. I mean, in each of these categories, the word diverse is applicable. Rick Riley wasn't just a one-sport guy. You know, I think of Jim Robson. Jim Robson was a famous broadcaster. I believe he, for many years, did the radio broadcast for, I want to say CJOR. It was 800 on the dial in Vancouver. It was a big station. It was sort of a talk radio kind of station. He did the broadcasts, so now this is him watching the hockey game and then broadcasting it onto radio. He became famous just for that. Then he would broadcast on TV and, you know, went into the Broadcaster Hall of Fame. Well, Jim Robson was a one-trick pony. He didn't do horse racing. He didn't do basketball. He didn't do football. He did hockey. And in Canada, that's enough. That's, you know, well, that's like Tom Landry doing football. You know, that's enough. No one ever wondered what Tom Landry was doing in the off-season. No one ever wondered what Jim Robson was doing in the off-season. But Rick Riley, I mean, I've seen his opinion pieces when I watch golf, and then, of course, football. And I think he really does it sort of no matter the subject. To me, sports is interesting as it is. Each sport is interesting. And for Riley to be in the position to be able to go to these tournaments, to meet these famous people, to interview them, he did something called a town center where he had like 15 episodes where he basically did a one-hour special on one person. So that's an even more in-depth piece on one person, because normally Rick Riley had to crank out a column. I assume they were once a week, something like that. It seems like they are on ESPN. And not a lot of words. I'm going to say 500 words. That's relatively easy to crank out. To spend an hour with someone, that's a little harder. And to do this, and to keep it up, and to keep up the high quality, and to keep up the freshness. Wow. 36 years of creating columns. In any field, for anyone to do this, that's amazing. Riley just, you know, and he always has a fresh spin on it. It's like you may not be interested in Riley when he starts, but by the end of his piece, you're interested. And for a number of weeks now, I've known that he was going to be doing his last column. I had had it in my Floydcast file to talk about it, I guess basically when it happened. Honestly, started dreading it. He's one of these great people that, it's like Olbermann, Keith Olbermann on ESPN, the guy who does the very funny, very opinionated take on sports. There's sports and then there's the coverage. And really this is what we're talking about, is the coverage end of it. You know, it used to be there was sports and that was it. There was no coverage. Many sports weren't covered at all. Even if it was covered, it was two guys with microphones going, yeah, this is what's happening now. No backstory. No special camera work. No special, I mean, the special mics was, I remember seeing them in Canada first, but probably, you know, in the U.S. at the same time. The boom mic, the very large, like a satellite dish. Guy walking the sidelines and pointing this satellite dish towards the game, trying to pick up sound. Well, now you get players that are mic'd up. They have a portable mic. You know, that's pretty amazing. And the nice thing with football, for what it's worth, is they don't pollute the game with this. The game could have become very gadgety, very Fox Channel, but it didn't. And so, for example, with the mic'd up, they'll use that for little specials, little bits, but they won't use it as part of the game, and that's good. Anyway, with Rick Riley, I wanted to go through some of the, just a smattering of some of the stuff that was submitted by famous sports personalities, writers, and people in the sports field. So there was a story called The Patience of Jim. And it was a story about Jim Kelly. Jim Kelly was a famous Buffalo Bills quarterback. Jim Kelly, and I had read this story when it came out. This was a story selected by somebody, but as it happened, I had read this story when it came out. Jim Kelly has had a lot of very bad breaks. The residual pain and complications from the injuries he got as a quarterback, they're all with him today. And affecting him, he has no feeling, and I forget whether part of his face or cancer losses. This would be a good one to look up, The Patience of Jim. I'd recommend reading it. But what I wanted to say just about that story, analyzing someone's name, Jim Kelly, Jim 955. The 955 of Jim, and even as James, he gets a five destiny. This guy is nothing but fives. In every name he uses, he has fives and or five totals. So Jim 955, very, very intense, idealistic, you know, support the underdog, always working on a cause. And that, you know, to others it appears admirable, but a Jim has no rest, no peace. Pushes themselves relentlessly to the point of exhaustion, and then does it again tomorrow. And bitter experiences, accidents. Kelly, last name, 562. There's the five again. 562 is discordant because the five, you might say, you know, it's a very ambitious, driven, let's do it quality. And the two is kind of the opposite, like, let's not do it, let's talk about it and then sit around, talk some more. So the second number is kind of like, it's like the first number is what you want to do that day, and the second number is what you, it's like you want to work in your garden. The first number is how much you want to do in your garden. The second number is what tools you're given. You know, with Kelly, the first number you want to do a lot in your garden, and then the second number, it's like you're given one packet of carrots and a hoe, and that's it. Or it's not even really that, because that's somewhat productive. It would be like, just walk around your garden and pull the odd weed, but mostly just talk to the neighbors. So sadly, the Kelly would be the combination that makes him seem very nice, very approachable, probably has a lot of friends type thing, but it doesn't help him. It doesn't help his mind. It doesn't give him peace of mind. It doesn't give him, you know, focus, memory, confidence. There's a lack of confidence there. So now when you add it all together anyway, if you had the bottom line Jim Kelly, you go to the destiny, right? Well, as James Kelly, it's a five destiny, accident destiny. Collisions on a football field destiny. What about with Jim Kelly? It's a 527, accident looking for a place to happen. I think the most remarkable thing with Jim Kelly is that he still has a good attitude, despite his name. I have to salute him for that. And then now you look at the name of the article, The Patience of Jim, and it fits, doesn't it? This guy has somehow survived his name. That's no small feat. Rick Riley used to write for Sports Illustrated, so one of the next stories that I chose from the ones people really liked, it's called The Official Fools of Golf. Not rules, but fools, that's the play on words. And this story, it's a longer setup bit here, but basically a guy was playing golf. His son was caddying, and his son let his 12-year-old, and his son's 14, so he's really young, he let his 12-year-old friend, Derek, carry the golfing father's putter for one hole. So, like, you're walking with your dad, he's doing a round of golf, and this is for money. This is, I don't know if this was at the PGA, I don't think it was, but let's say one level below the PGA. You know, this was a tournament that mattered. It wasn't just friendly golf. So his friend, you know, hey, can I carry the putter type thing? And sure, you know, one hole. The golfing father looked and saw what had happened, and he realized we had a problem. Because you're only allowed in the rules of golf, the fools of golf, you're only allowed to have one caddy for a round. And technically, by that 12-year-old carrying a putter for one hole, he was a caddy. The dad got disqualified. And now this piece was, you know, Rick Riley going, hey, this is ridiculous. And it was interesting that there were some other connections of the official that disqualified him, and then there was something else that, you know, I would encourage you to read the story. Some other stuff that Rick Riley dug up. But what's the name of the son who allowed the friend to carry the putter? Seth. S-E-T-H. 527. Accident looking for a place to happen. Something as innocent as that, when you have a 527, you don't get away with it. It turns into a disaster, not just a, you know, let's say the average person you loan your putter to, a 12-year-old to carry, and he drops it. Hey, don't do that. Oh, okay. No harm done. In this case, his dad is disqualified from a tournament, and I think he was, you know, doing pretty good. Okay, next one was called Wrestling with Conviction. And this story is about Cassie Herkelman, a female wrestler who wrestles boys as well. Now, I thought what would be interesting in this case, there's no accent looking for a place to happen here, by the way, is just to analyze her name and say, what would a person with this name do? So Cassie, 1-3-4. That's like the name David. 1 and 4. The one, that physical, kind of narrowed focus, kind of masculine quality. And then the 4 is the muscles, and the 4 is, can be quite strong. Good balance. Herkelman, 246. With a 246, think of it like it can go with other numbers. It'll fit in with other numbers. 371 total. That's like Gordon. Gordon is 371. I ran into a person with a 371, and I realized, wow, are they confrontational? This person, it was just like you just didn't want to be around them after just a few seconds. So 371 can be a disagreeable combination, an arguing combination. The 3, you know, is 3 likes an argument. The 3 is sort of wants to have some fun. But 371, when you narrow it down with the 1, remember the tools for your garden. The 3 wants to have a garden with everything. A garden with flowers and food, and they want to have some fun in their garden. And then the 1 is, okay, you've got rocks, you've got a pickaxe, you've got a slope, and you got some beets. Kind of thing. You know, beets are good for you, but they're not as much fun as planting flowers. So, Cassie Herkelman, total 371, one destiny. The masculine destiny, the male quality, the one quality, the seed, the pioneer, the start, the physical force. So she had a 1 prominent in her first name and a 1 destiny. Well, those are masculine qualities. And I guess the story that Rick starts off talking about, wrestling with conviction, I guess there was a wrestler that didn't want to wrestle her. And supposedly, this guy didn't think it was right to wrestle her. And of course, she's been wrestling guys for years, apparently, and beating them. And maybe it was just his way to opt out of losing. Anyway, so that's, again, Rick covering a variety of things. That might have been my last Rick piece that I was going to talk about in this particular Floydcast. One thing I did want to talk about is in his last column, which these ones I was just reading to you were the tribute column that was sort of linked to it, but in Rick's actual last column, and he had some great last columns, by the way, he led up to his own departure really quite nicely. You know, retrospective, right? He went through, over the last month, he went through and, you know, who was the player he enjoyed the most and enjoyed the least and all that kind of stuff. But this quote that I'm really savoring, don't ever let anyone tell you it's just sports. that really resonates with me. You know, for people who aren't into sports, sports must be... Oh, great. Flood's talking about sports again. Hang on, Pete. Point number one with sports, right, is it's the real world. Point number two is, you know, with almost every sport you watch on TV, you yourself could try that sport. You might like it. So with sports, you can try a sport for yourself. And it might be a liberation for you. My dad talked so much about getting in the groove of doing something. When he would ride his bike, he would get in the groove. Well, what he meant was, he really liked it. He really valued that groove. He sought for that place, and he found that place. And many people do this with sports. And it's not escapism, because when my father rode his bike, he was getting somewhere. My father rode to work for years, for decades. He rode to work when he worked at pulp mills and oil refineries and places that are hard hat zones, tough people. My father was just never one to follow stereotypes and to care what other people thought. It made sense for him to ride his bike. This is 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and he rode his bike. Well, my father was really good at many different sports. He would play golf. I played golf with my father a handful of times, let's say maybe 3 times, 4 times. It was sort of in my later years, my later time with him, when I was well set up work-wise, and I'd go and take my summer holidays, some of my summer holidays, and spend them with him. We might golf once in that week or in that 10 days. And we'd play like a little miserable pitch and putt, miserable being, you know, very small, modest course, 100 to 150 yard long holes. Maybe it was miserable to me because I've always been so horrible at golf. But my dad had a beautiful, natural swing. And it just typified what he was like and how it all worked together with my dad. Riding your bike, that kept you in shape, right? Cardiovascular, right? He played tennis. We played a lot of tennis together. Well, that probably helped him with the golf. But he just had his eye in for things. He worked in the garden. That contact with the earth, again, more exercise. You know, you could say my dad was a real exercise nut. Well, my dad loved physics. My dad loved reading Scientific American articles, reading books, science fiction. What I find these days when I run across people who read or do any one of those things is they usually don't do the other things. If they're really into sports, they're usually not into science fiction. And also, my father was into Zen. He had a very strong spiritual side. And basically, putting words in my dad's mouth, my dad's version of Zen to me was, it's up to you yourself. Figure things out for yourself, have a good attitude, and be philosophical when things happen to you, when things go bad. But there's something about sports. Maybe it's because sports are perpetually humbling, especially these days. You know, if you played golf 200 years ago, you didn't know what anyone else was doing, right? There was no TV. There wasn't much, you know, publicity, media about it. You just went and played, right? And if you did better on that course than you did the week before, you felt good. It was just a comparison with yourself. As we see other people and the greats around us, it can be humbling. Well, that's good. So many of our problems today are because the people in power are not humble. Rather than learning from others and fitting in with others and keeping their perspective, they don't care about others. They don't need a perspective on others because they treat others like dirt. And if someone dies or loses a job because of them, they couldn't care less. It's about their bottom line, nothing else. That's the people that are running this show, running this world. Absolutely ruthless, heartless people. Despite all the political correct stuff in the media, you know, they're always clever, right? They're always saying one thing and doing another. You know, the trend nowadays is for football players to wear pink. They don't care about cancer. They are creating cancer. They don't care about people starving. They are creating that starvation. So Rick Riley was a tremendously human writer. Someone that made us care even more about sports. For contrast, I'm thinking of the NBC Olympics. NBC does these little bits on athletes as part of the Olympics. And it doesn't fit. It's annoying. It's part of their formula. Instead of giving you, you know, wall-to-wall coverage, which you'll get in Canada, you'll get tens of hours of coverage per day. In America, when the Olympics are on, you get hours of coverage if you don't mind scouring the dial wearing out your remote control time trying to figure out what's on where. But in prime time, you get 20 minutes of sports, 30 minutes of bits on people, and 30 minutes of commercials. And then, honestly, by the time I get to that point, I've lost interest. It kind of gets all the priorities of sports backwards. Well, Rick Riley always kept the priorities the right way around. For example, Rick Riley just sort of always had issues with Tiger Woods. I think as time has passed, we understand, we get it, finally. Don't ever let anyone tell you it's just sports. I think it's really a lot of good words in there. Sports can be a friend. There's so many forms of sports. When I was a kid walking to school, kicking a rock. I used to wear out shoes kicking rocks. And then my mom sort of commented, hey, you're wearing out the toes of your shoes. And I was like, okay, I got to kick better. So I learned to kick rocks without touching the ground. Just hit the rock, not the ground. Well, that's sports. That's taking sports to rock kicking. I used to walk to school twice a day, so home for lunch. I went to schools in two different directions. We were kind of on the edge of the district. It was about a mile either way. And we were on a hill, and so it was up and down the hill twice. And when I was in junior high, in particular, the hill that you had to climb was about 500 feet. Or it seemed like 500 feet. Maybe it was only 200. And my goal was I used to try and stride up this hill, and it's as steep as you'll see a hill, probably 10-12% grade, maybe more. And I used to try and stride, so meaning, if you imagine your biggest stride, where you swing your feet out in front of you rather than, like when you're climbing a mountain, you sort of bend your legs, and it's like you're climbing a ladder. When you use your legs to climb a ladder, it's different than when you are out for a walk, a fast walk. A walk where you're trying to cover a large distance with each stride, that's what I'm getting at. And so I used to try and stride up this hill, this super steep hill. Well, I'll tell you, it gave me thighs for life. To the point where, when I was at that school, I had this, you know, as a kid you're trying to dress cool, right? And I had this cool pair of jeans, very faded and worn out jeans and bell bottoms at the time. And they were so tight around my thighs that when I coughed, my thighs would spasm. So that was because I had developed my thigh muscles so much. I mean, how often do you hear someone that their thighs don't fit their jeans? As the only part that didn't fit. Everything else fit, the waist, the length. Well, that's sports. That's bringing sports to walking to and from school. That's two different ways to do it. Oh, Rick Riley, I'm really going to miss that guy. No holds barred. No kidding. Really going to miss him. I'm someone that I scour looking for interesting stuff every week, and Rick Riley was someone you could count on for sure. He does have audiobooks, and I'm going to get to those. And I'd like to see something more from Rick. I'd like to see a longer something. And not a, from what I'm aware, at least one of his audiobooks, which I've got sitting here, is a fiction. I don't want to read a fiction. Sorry. Make it the real world, Rick. You've got a lot to offer there. Okay, quick transition bit. There's a movie right now in the theaters called A Million Ways to Die in the West. I don't go to movie theaters. I find the movie experience horrible. The sound is usually way too loud. The screens are blurry and poorly focused. You got people flipping cell phones around you. You have to synchronize your whole life around going to a movie. By the time I sit down in a seat, I feel like falling asleep. I like to be more active when I'm watching a movie. But I just wanted to comment on this movie, A Million Ways to Die in the West, and say, who would write that? Who would sit down? What normal person would sit down and write about a million ways to die in the West? And have that as the title of your book. I could see, you know, hard times in the West and, you know, that pioneering spirit. And those are sort of uplifting thoughts, right? Times were tough, but we made it. We pioneered. We only had a dirt floor and a wood stove. The winters were long and cold, but we survived and thrived. A Million Ways to Die in the West. It doesn't sound like surviving and thriving. Well, anyway, what's the author's name? Seth MacFarlane. Seth again. 527. That's what a 527 writes about. A Million Ways to Die in the West. And the five can be a morbid quality. And for someone that attracts a lot of accidents in their life, they could come up with a million ways to die in the West. They could do it. So that's sort of my transition from talking about sports to talking more about the name. What I wanted to do was I wanted to talk about two different other stories to do with the name. One of them is something that happened nearby. A student took weapons to school, and bottom line, a teacher got shot, another student got shot and died. And I just wanted to analyze the names of all these people, because by the next day this was all public knowledge. You know, this is a tragedy, truly. I guess the gunman, his name combinations, he had a 652 first name, but two lacks confidence. It's amazing how often a two-ish person will do something that's unladylike, that's not very nice. I think it sort of represents the despair of the two. The two doesn't want to work hard for stuff. You know, there's sort of an entitlement, an expectation they wanted it handed to them. And when they don't get it, the two can try and take the easy way. I guess this guy got into the gun cabinet at home. That's what started all this. Anyway, middle name 696, last name 641. He had a 999 total. That is the tragedy total. So right there, if this gunman didn't have that tragedy total, this wouldn't have happened. So then you got to say, well, what about the people that got shot? That's where you're thinking, hey, accident, looking for a place to happen, right? Well, sure enough, the teacher that got shot, Todd, and his last name, 527, accident, looking for a place to happen. And then when you, Todd plus the last name, he had a 235 total and a 5 destiny. 235 total, exactly the same as James Kelly. Basically, this poor guy had similar numbers to Jim Kelly. His numbers are just shouting out that bad things are going to happen to him. Even though he's a teacher, right? He's building up good karma of being a teacher. Todd 617. The 6 is the number of the teacher. The name Todd, he's a deep thinker. Could be the physics teacher. Wouldn't surprise me. And in fairness, you know, when a gunman goes to your school, someone's going to take a bullet. In many cases, unfortunately. And in a way, it's not fair to pick out one over another. There's a certain element of random chance to it, right? But still, his numbers point clearly to him taking the bullet. And then there was a student, 279 first name, 729 last name, 999 total. And this student got shot by the gunman and died. So a tragedy total took guns to school, shot and killed a student who also had a tragedy total. So first of all, they attracted each other, right? Same combination. When you have the same combination, you attract people who have that same combination. Well, apparently this guy, 279, 729, 999 total, he stepped in, he tried to do something. And that's the higher side of the numbers of the nines, is trying to give, right? Trying to be the specialist. The nine is a specialist. The nine steps in whatever way is needed. Unfortunately, he paid for it with his life. And that's what they say about the 999. You give, 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 give. And the second you try and take, you die. The second you try and take, you have a tragedy. This guy gave to the end. He did live the higher side of his numbers, but you know, just standing back a couple of feet, most of us don't want to have to die to live the higher side of our numbers. And this is why this person didn't have a good name. So this is a sad story about people with bad names. So, Chuck Noll, trying to balance out my name story so that there's a good name in there. Well, the name Noll is a good name, 628 name, balanced, strong, good values. Probably was born Charles, right? Charles Noll, so that would be 663, 628, 382. A lot of good qualities there. Charles by itself is a balanced first name. You know, you can do better, but it's a very fine first name. It's a likable name. He gets called Chuck. Chuck is 371. Well, we just did a 371. The girl who fights guys, who wrestles guys, she had a 371 total. It's a so that's a tough masculine. That's a fighting total, 371. So there was Chuck Noll. You know, he had some good qualities. Actually, probably a gentle guy, based on Charles Noll. And from a stable, proper family, I would say. But then he was the fighter. It's 371. The three wants the fun, the action, the make people, get people excited, and then the one is physical. Do it in a way that's physical. Well, football's pretty physical. So there was Chuck Noll being the coach for years of, he coached for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and one of the excerpts I wanted talk about was it said, one of the stories said, incredibly enough, he never won an NFL Coach of the Year award, even though he is the only coach to win 4 Super Bowls. Few, if any, coaches in NFL history had a more profound effect on their franchise. Well, getting back to about the people with the balanced name and that, you know, they're not the showy names. They're not the conflict name. They're not the name that... Well, they're just sort of not extreme in any way, right? They have values, they have principles, they work hard, they get results. That was Chuck Noll, clearly. He was personifying that last name. Another quote from a different ESPN sort of summary article. He was not a pizzazz guy. He knew where he was, where he was going, and where he wanted to go, and how to do it. He had a very, very strong moral compass. My dad respected that. So the guy saying this, his dad, the guy who said it was Art Rooney Jr., his dad, Art Rooney, owns the New England Patriots, a competing football team. Well, the New England Patriots, you know, it's kind of a class act, that whole franchise, and Art Rooney is known around the league being a class act. So those are some pretty fine words about a coach for a competing team. But, you know, that very, very strong moral compass, that would be the 6th quality in that family name. But also, Chuck Noll, he had a 999 total. And that's that, it can be a tragedy total, right? Just like the gunman had a 999 total, and the student that got shot and killed had a 999 total. Well, Chuck Noll had a 999 total, but he lived the higher side. Now, this isn't a sales pitch for having a 999 total. You don't want it. If you looked at Chuck Noll's life, I think pretty quickly you'd be saying, well, he may be good at football, but it does show that, you know, there are some, and it becomes their lifelong quest to live the higher side of their name. When you have a fully balanced name, first name, last name, and total, you don't have this lifelong battle. You get busy with your life. You've got the tools for the job. You know what you want to plant in your garden, and you've got every tool at your disposal, every seed. It's all organized, and away you go. So continuing the sports theme, this was a massive week for sports this last week. Hang on, Pete. All right, in the past week, there's been the NBA Finals, that's basketball finals, and it appears the Miami Heat might have finally met their match. The Heat won last year and the year before, they won everything. And they seemed like they were on their way this year, but they ran into San Antonio Spurs. I'm sorry, I'm guessing here. Hang on. Yep, I had to go and check. San Antonio Spurs could win in the next game. So, you know, the best of NBA basketball this week. U.S. Open Golf, one of the four major golf tournaments of the year. One of the little bits of trivia about the U.S. Open, broadcast to 180 countries. 180 countries. I mean, just imagine the logistics of broadcasting to 180 countries. Imagine what some of those countries are like. I don't know if Afghanistan is getting it, probably. Just imagine who in Afghanistan, what building, what kind of services do they have, what kind of power do they have, even just to the building that's receiving this signal. And then they got to rebroadcast it, you know, locally and have local Afghanistan ads. 180. 18 countries would be significant. There's only something like 230 to 250 countries. 180 of them are getting the U.S. Open of Golf. I was kind of blown away by that. I picked Jordan Spieth for the Masters and for the Players' Championship. And in the Masters, I think he was, you know, he was close. He was in second place for quite a bit of the Masters. I think he might have dropped to third or fourth, but he did really well. He's a new player. And in the Players, he was like neck and neck with Martin Keimer in the final day type thing and had a shot, but then Martin Keimer was just that one notch better. So for this tournament, I picked Martin Keimer at the start of the tournament. Most of the professional analysis didn't seem to be picking Keimer. There was a big deal made about Phil Mickelson trying to win another major and trying to win the U.S. Open. Phil Mickelson has won, you know, the Masters and the other majors, the British Open last year, I think, and he's won the other ones. Phil Mickelson's a great guy and a great golfer. And I was like, no, he is so not going to come close to winning this week. And sure enough, he didn't. Phil's getting old. And one of the things in sports is that, you know, people get better as time goes on. It doesn't matter the sport. I was watching the spelling bee this year, and those spellers are better than they used to be. In fact, it was a tie because they got right to the end and then they got to the 25 challenge words and then they spelled them all correctly and they ran out of words. It's not the first time that's happened, but everybody was talking in the spelling bee about how good all the competitors were. It was obvious to me, and I'd watched it, you know, quite a few years. So Martin Kammerer was my man. And I just saw in the Players' Championship, the previous almost major, fifth major as they call it, Kammerer was just sort of unflappable and just so solid and basically sort of perfect in all parts of the game. Well, what did Mr. Kammerer do this last week? Today's Sunday, so the fourth and final 18 holes are today. There's been 3 days so far. Kammerer shot record low scores Thursday and Friday. In fact, he backed up on Friday the exact same record low score that he shot on Thursday. They had never shot 5 under par in the U.S. Open. He did it on Thursday, and then he did it again on Friday. Just unreal. He set a record for the lowest score after 2 rounds, and he tied scores about the fastest to get to 10 under and all this. Anyway, then he played yesterday and they totally changed the course. The PGA people, the tournament organizers, they made every pin placement as tough as you can imagine. I've never seen anything like it. To give you an idea, people would be on the green, putting towards the hole. I saw this repeatedly several times yesterday. They're trying to putt towards the hole and they putted off the green. That's because these greens are so crowned and so dry and so fast that you can't stop the ball. Martin Kammerer himself, he had a chance to watch someone else putt on his line, which means that it's like the ideal situation where you can learn from them how to hit it. And he proceeded to putt it off the green, despite that. That was like maybe the most oddball, remarkable shot of the whole year in my mind. Anyway, he persisted. I think he had a 6-shot lead at the start of the day, and he finished with a 5-shot lead. Because this guy, even though he got his share of bogeys yesterday, he also got an eagle, and he got a birdie on the final hole. And I guess Martin Kammerer has a reputation of, when he wins, it's not uncommon for him to win by a lot. Well, this is unusual in golf. So anyway, Martin Kammerer, very interesting guy to watch, and U.S. Open Golf this week. Usually with golf, I'm very excited. I love all the build-up and the analysis. This week, for some reason, I was a little less involved in the build-up, possibly because there were other sports to watch. Okay, one last U.S. Open golf story. Quote, Jason Miller didn't get to Pinehurst. This is me paraphrasing. So this was a golfer that had qualified for Pinehurst and was going to go play. And by the way, U.S. Open, even nobody's off the street can qualify. If you qualify at each level, the movie Tin Cup is based on a U.S. Open tournament. And so the idea is that nobody, Roy McIlvoy, gets to qualify for the U.S. Open. Well, Jason Miller was one of these nobodies who qualified. He was on his way, 500-mile drive. He had driven for over an hour, and he turned around. He felt guilty that he might have grounded his club but not reported it and therefore didn't take the 2-stroke penalty that would have been involved. And if he had done all that in his qualifying round, he wouldn't have qualified for the U.S. Open. And his guilt, supposedly, was enough that he turned around. Jason Millard, what's his name? Jason? 775. Accident looking for a place to happen. I mean, an accident happened to this guy while he was on his way to the U.S. Open. This is the Valhalla of golf. The way they're talking about this tournament, by the way, Pinehurst, the home of golf and all these high praise, high praise. And it is an interesting tournament, and I'll give them that. But anyway, this guy, he couldn't live with himself, and he quit before he started. I mean, you can admire it. The story was admiring him and saying he did the right thing kind of thing. But that's the accident looking for a place to happen that he got himself into that pickle. Because with a different name, he would have, if he grounded his club, he would have reported it. And it's probably only, you know, a one shot. Someone else would have taken a one shot and they would have, a different quality would have bounced back and still qualified. Many of us would have, we could be, me personally, I could be unsure whether I grounded my club or not. And if I didn't think I did at the time, and even if I still had doubt later on, if I qualified for the U.S. Open, I'd play in the U.S. Open. Yeah, it would bother me. It would bother me that I hadn't, let's put it this way, that I wasn't clear about whether I grounded it or not, but I would let it go. I mean, Part of living a good life is make your decision and move on. This poor guy couldn't do it. He tormented himself. It's like he had to fail. He had to fail. It's almost like he had to find a reason to fail. One of the things they say about the seven qualities is sometimes they have a fear of success. This guy seems to have had a fear of success. Okay, so that's U.S. Open Golf. It's also World Cup Soccer has started. I think it started Thursday. Brazil played, forgot the team, they won. And then Friday, there was a bunch of games. And then yesterday, there were four games. I think it's the most of this round robin stage, the first stage of round robin, where teams play other teams within their section. Just eight sections. And then the top two out of four teams in each section advance to the next round. And so it goes, and then you start playing elimination matches where only the winners advance, and eventually you get to the final game. So the first round's important. It's important to win, or even a tie is better than not winning. And you also want to win by, they call it goal differential. If you and another team have the same record, but you've scored more goals, then your goal differential is better, and you will advance. All right, so Spain, I guess, is the previous champions from 4 years ago. And they played the Netherlands. The Netherlands was the runner-up 4 years ago. Well, the Netherlands crushed Spain 5-1. It's the worst beatdown ever of a defending champion, apparently. So, soccer. It's great. It can be great. Soccer's a little hard to watch, especially when U.S. Open is on. Well, I've got to be honest, I only watch, you know, sort of bits of each game enough to get the tone. And speaking of tone and bad tone, Uruguay played Costa Rica yesterday. And this was easily the worst soccer game so far. And this is good old corruption coming to the fore. The referee is Felix Brych, B-R-Y-C-H, Brych, in German. And I looked at his name combination, Felix 562, so the 5 and the 2. Bad combination, we've already talked about it today with Kelly, right? Brych, 742. 742 is like Mario. It's a dreamy combination. 742 doesn't have backbone, it doesn't have clarity. So he has all these twos around. Remember we talked about the tools. The two quality is frankly the worst quality for tools. Tools get jobs done. The two doesn't want to get a job done. The two wants to take the easy way out and do the least amount of work and do the most amount of talking. Well, when you're a referee, talking isn't an option. So this guy, his name combination, I just went, I am seriously worried about this ref. He's the only ref I happen to analyze. Because I just happened to catch that part of the broadcast where they show you the referees and whatnot. And I happened to be, you know, paying attention. Well, this game was a refereeing disaster. And here's what happens. A player does something that's obviously a foul. They grab the player instead of going after the ball. They kick someone. And this main official, this main referee, he didn't call it. Or if he called it, he didn't give someone a yellow card. Yellow card says, do it again, you're kicked out. Your team is short one player the rest of the match. When you give someone a yellow card, especially early, you send a message. You say, I'm not going to put up with this. That was way out of line. And people, the whole tone of the game changes. This guy did the opposite. He did nothing. He did nothing over and over again. I stopped watching after 10 or 15 minutes. It was so bad. I come back, you know, periodically over the next, you know, the course of the match. For every 5 minutes that you watch, there's a foul a minute. That were completely way out of line, inappropriate. Someone should have been almost kicked out of the game. He gave no yellow cards. This game, Uruguay-Costa Rica, was ruined by the official. And by the way, it was obvious to me watching the first part of the game that Uruguay was the better team. Costa Rica won. I blame the official, without a doubt. I've played sports with cheating teams, and I know what cheating does to the game. It's up to the referees to ruthlessly rule that stuff out, to thoroughly weed that stuff out of the game. They can easily ruin a game, easily. People are not nice. You give them a chance in a sporting event and cheaters will cheat. Desperate people will do desperate things. So that was really unfortunate, and that has actually, that's my low light of the soccer. Now there's been some great goals. There was a header in one of the games. It was remarkable. There's been some, you know, some great shots and great goals. There's been some good play. Teams, I have to say, the soccer, they look better than I've seen in previous years. And other than that one unwatchable game, the quality of play has been high, and that speaks well to the future. By the way, today, my man Lionel Messi is playing. Argentina's playing later today. Looking forward to that. As always, England lost. This is yesterday, Saturday, their first game England lost. England's horrible in soccer. It's sort of ironic, right? That's where the Premier League is, the best soccer league in the world, is basically based out of England. But when it comes to World Cup, they're horrible. I think part of the problem with the World Cup is that the coaches are often these old farts. They were talking about a coach yesterday, and they said he was the second youngest coach, and he was 42. I think of the Miami Heat and the guy there, who's the current coach there, that young guy. And he was like some nobody working in the basement, literally. And he clawed his way up and he became a coach. And he's a very young guy. And suddenly he's running the Heat and he's got championship rings on his fingers. A coach doesn't have to be old to be good. And in soccer especially, I think an old coach is bad. Really bad. I don't know why, I've never liked it. And you see these old guys. I think, you know, soccer, for some reason, the coach is really important. I played soccer. I've had bad coaches. My dad was a good coach. My dad was innovative. My dad coached a team of oddball, I was going to say farmer's sons, when we lived in the interior of British Columbia. When we moved there, my dad sort of got to know the locals, and there was a little makeshift baseball diamond nearby, and we used to go up there and throw a frisbee, throw a football, and we met the locals, and we played soccer with them, and then my dad started coaching them. And then they started playing for the local city, and they got good. And then they started playing throughout the province, and they got good. And then they were even eventually flying to, I think they were Portuguese, flying to Portugal to play Portuguese teams. Well, my father was part of that progression. He taught them principles. These other teams, in the little town where they played, they started off playing, there was the town team. And this was all the All-American boys, you know, this is Canada, but all the All-American boys, the big, tall, strong, sporting types. And our little Portuguese misfits, eventually they beat this other team. And they did it with will. They did it with being in better shape. And they did it with much smarter soccer. Well, there's something about soccer that many people don't get it. Western countries don't get it as much as, you know, Latin countries like Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Uruguay, all those countries, they get it more. It's a passing game. If you don't pass, you lose. England, their idea of passing is to hit the ball above 50 yards, and they think that's a pass. And what that is that's desperation. They call them crossing passes. You're basically punting the ball. You're basically giving the ball up for a 50-50. And then, of course, people head it. My dad hated heading. I don't like heading. Heading is random. You randomly head it, and now it's 50-50 again. You'd often see, this used to be, you know, 10 and 20 years ago, you'd see it headed, and then you'd see it headed again, and the third time and the fourth time. Well, luckily, this year, 2014, a lot less heading. A lot less ridiculous long kicks that are basically giving the ball away. In fact, you know, it's an easy way to find out if a team is going to suck. Do they do these big long kicks? Well, they're not going anywhere. England, I missed most of the game because I was watching the golf, but I'm glad to see them losing a game. They're sort of legends in their own mind, kind of like the British film industry is a legend in its own mind. They think they make good movies and they're horrible. England, get your act together. Seriously. Embarrassing. Okay, so one more big sporting thing this past week. Okay, the biggest event in basketball last week, one of the biggest events in golf last week, definitely the biggest event in soccer started this last week, and then the biggest event in hockey this last week, the finals in the hockey, what they call the Stanley Cup. Hockey's been around a long time. This is a great sport. It's very fast, very exciting. Well, I got a chance to watch what turned into the final game of the season. It was the LA Kings playing New York Rangers. Kings were up 3-1, so if the Kings won this game, they'd win the whole thing. So Rangers are desperate. Kings are playing at home. This game was exciting to watch from start to finish. There was almost 100 shots in the game. End to end to end to end action. That's how I, in my notes, that's what I wrote down. The commentator pointed out more than once, well, it said 5 minutes of nonstop action. Hockey is so tiring that it's not uncommon for a shift to last 30 seconds. But when you have 5 minutes of nonstop action, how do you change shift? How do you substitute? Well, they do it on the fly. And they don't always do it. Some players will stay out for longer than everybody else. They weren't able to get off, and then they start getting tired. This dynamic makes the game very interesting, very exciting. Makes it the opposite of basketball. Basketball, they don't substitute. You get the main players playing typically the whole game. If they get tired, or if the other team gets on a run in basketball, oh, timeout. They have double or quadruple the timeouts of other sports. Hockey has no timeouts. I don't recall seeing a timeout in this game, and if there is one, it's because someone just lost half their face. I'm sorry to be graphic, but they just lost a few teeth and they're pouring blood on the ice, and then they'll take a couple minutes to clean the ice and get back to hockey. In fact, they made a point of saying in one of the periods that they passed the 10-minute mark in the period, and there was a mandatory break to clean the ice, to make sure the ice was... This wasn't a thorough clean, but I imagine sort of a cosmetic cleaning where you make sure that maybe around the goal or certain areas, the loose ice shavings haven't accumulated, that kind of thing. If there's any ruts or bad gouges in the ice, you repair those. But the point is that it was so nonstop that they were turning this ice into pulp. Amazing. Easily the most exciting sports I watched all week. Pound for pound, minute for minute. I was standing up watching it. People at the game, you could see them standing up next to the glass watching the game. And the commentator commented on it and said, you know, the game is just so exciting that these people just can't sit down. And they had what we used to call in Vancouver, Canada, at the Coliseum, we call them the red seats, you know, the best seats. These people had the best seats. If they sat down, they would be not too different from where they were. There was no one in front of them, but they were standing up. It was that exciting. Alec Martinez scored the winner. I went and analyzed his name and everything, and honestly, I didn't expect too much to stand out because it's such a team game. Anyone can win, anyone can score. But it turned out this guy who scored the game-winning, the Game 7 overtime winning, it's his second one of the year. That's pretty deserving. Anyway, 663 first name, 617, and as is our pattern today, a 371 total. That's three people today. All have a 371, and they're all in sports. Well, the three love sports, without a doubt. It's competitive in a friendly way, but then the one is, let's get down to brass tacks. And when you're talking professional sports, you're talking brass tacks. And so there was this three-ish guy. I even worked out his cycle. He's in a five-year, so it's a Mission Impossible year. And he's under a three letter, and the letters of the name are important, and he's under a three letter. A three is the lucky quality, so, you know, it kind of fit that he was doing well, but nothing, you know, too standout. Again, maybe this is an example like Chuck Knoll, or when someone is really good and have good qualities, they don't stand out, they just get the game winner. That's what I have to say with this guy. He's got two sixes in his name, six in the first name, six in the last name, six is the number of bounds. That's serious, dedicated, clear-headed combination, and there he is getting these game winners. Went to the second overtime, 100 minutes of play, and this 100 minutes, it's as demanding as soccer, if not more so. I guess more so, because in soccer, you know, people on the field take turns and some of them are walking. In this hockey game, at no time was anyone going at a walking pace. They were all sprinting almost all the time. The end-to-end rushes, I hadn't been following the hockey that closely, but even in the course of the game, you quickly get to know who are the really great players. And you would see them get the puck, and it was like things were immediately very exciting. Oh, and it turned out that the winning team, LA Kings, who won the whole thing this year, they were down earlier in the year in a series 3-0. And in hockey, it's not uncommon for a team to come back from being down 3-0. That means they have to win 4 in a row. This never happens in basketball. Again, this is a bad sign, right? In basketball, people lose interest. Like with the basketball right now, with the Heat, and they got one more game to play and everything, people have lost interest. Even the Heat had lost interest. In the last game, you could see it. It was a blowout. The Spurs beat them badly. And it was like the game got out of hand, and you could just see everyone kind of went, well, we'll wait till the next game. This game's done. Hockey, no. No. It doesn't happen that way. The other thing I wanted to give a shout-out about was the commentator, Mike Emmerich. This guy was so good, and his voice is so fantastic. Such a great hockey voice. I went and studied this guy. Well, it turns out this guy studied speech when he went to university or college. He's the first media person ever inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. And he's done this commentating job for 41 years. He's 67 years old. What's amazing is you look at his picture and you listen to his voice, he sounds like he's 37. He's so young, so energetic, so deserving. He is used as a consultant on the game. They say his knowledge of the game is encyclopedic. He's known for his eloquent vocabulary. He'll insert some really great, colorful, interesting stuff into little slight lulls in the action. I mean, you know, for comparison, you know, baseball is nothing but lulls in the action. Golf is mostly lulls in the action. Even football has its downtime. Hockey doesn't. I mean, those 5 minutes of nonstop action, he was calling the play-by-play nonstop for 5 minutes. But he still fits in these really eloquent things. They're really quite delicious. I encourage you to check them out if you can. Peter King, a sports writer, said, Doc Emrick is one H-E-L-L of a hockey announcer. If hockey were big in this country, America, he'd be what Jack Buck used to be. Jack Buck was the great baseball announcer. By the way, Jack Buck's son, Joe Buck, is equal. Joe Buck is exceptional, and luckily, Joe Buck also does football in addition to baseball. There's a lot more I could say about this guy, but there was one last little paragraph. I think this is from Wikipedia. He's the founding member and president of the NHL Pronunciation Guide, which is used as a guide by all NHL broadcasters for some of hockey's most difficult names. That in itself, it's like that'd be an honor itself. Because, I mean, these guys play, they're from all countries, right? And so their names are challenging. And, of course, he's saying these names on the fly, instantly recognizing who has the puck and who's passing it to who, and inserting all of his other, you know, encyclopedic, as I read out earlier, that's truly this guy. He is vice president of the NHL Broadcasters Association, and he's also a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame Selection Committee. So not only is he the first into the Hockey Hall of Fame, he's on the Selection Committee. This dude is awesome. One of the great things with hockey is, hockey's one of the few sports that you can thoroughly enjoy without watching. On the one hand, it doesn't fit. Hockey is visually fantastic. You could watch hockey easily without having any sound on, and I've done it. But similarly, you can watch it with no visuals and only sound. And maybe that's because hockey is so fantastically engrossing, so fantastically challenging. In a way, hockey is like team boxing. Now, boxing is, you know, savage. And there is a savage part of hockey. But what I mean by that is, in boxing, it's no holds barred. In boxing, it's all out. If you mix, you know, maybe it's like MMA is a better way to describe it. MMA, the mixed martial arts. In MMA, it is no holds barred, right? You're allowed to kick as well as punch and wrestle. And the guy taps out. I find MMA too savage to watch. But the point is that you're fully committed. And in hockey, not only are you individually fully committed, but the team is fully committed. So, for me, hockey, that was the sport of the week. And something of a surprise, and I only caught all of one game, but it just brought home once again how great hockey is as a sport to watch. I had a lot of notes, a lot of articles, put a lot of thought into my Floydcast this week. You know, whenever I do that, whenever I put a lot of prep work into the Floydcast, then I always feel like, am I cheating my other articles? Like, because to me, the Floydcast feel a little bit like a bit of a throwaway. You do it and then you're on to the next week kind of thing. Whereas an article, like my fluoride articles, we're up to like 500 views on one. I redid the video, and then the second one is up to 500 views as well. My articles on, even on parsley, is doing really well. A lot of my health articles seem to be the ones people are focusing on, not my physics one, which is understandable. But when you create those articles, especially on important subjects, they last a long time. They have a far-reaching impact. The Floydcast, I may be wrong, but it seems, at least at this stage when six people are listening to it, it seems to have less reach. And so I sort of question myself, second-guess myself. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, a Floydcast, they're all going to be on my site, and they also have a permanence to them. They have a rewatchability to them as well. Arguably, I think re-listenability is higher on the Floydcast because it's meant to be entertaining, it's meant to be more balanced. You know, some of my stuff is sort of hard-hitting in one area. So, lots of material. Save some for next week, that's no problem. So I want to get to the of the weeks. I'm calling them now the categories of the weeks. So, bad driver of the week. I was going to Costco, driving to Costco to do my shopping, love Costco. And where I live, I'm not sure it's true everywhere. The lights are somewhat predictable. So as I'm rounding a corner, I'm already going, this light's probably going to be red. More often than not, it is red. I come around the corner, it's red. I'm slowing down. And I look over to my left, and the person next to me is just about to come to a stop at the light. And they whipped out their cell phone as if they were going to swat a bee with it. The desperation, the intensity, the completely... I mean, they were whipping out their cell phone before they were stopped. Yes, they were coming to a stop. Yes, if you leave that amount of pressure on your brakes, you will eventually stop. And yes, you know, they didn't hit anybody. Way to go. Why on earth are you that hooked on your cell phone? What is the big deal? This person wasn't even texting. In other words, they weren't actively doing something. They were just checking their phone. Something might have happened in the last 3 minutes. They weren't getting driving directions. I've seen people, you know, they're in the middle of a call. If you're in the middle of a call, then there may be something important about that call. You may be getting directions. It could be something earth-shattering has happened and you have to be dealing with it. Of course, you should pull over if that's the case. But it has the potential of being somewhat justified. You're doing something. And 1 in 50 people is able to, they call them super multitaskers. 1 in 50 people can actually do two things at once. They can drive and text or drive and something else. The other 49, well, they're good at trying to do two things at once and then getting in an accident, killing somebody. Just checking your phone? Really? It's got to that. You know, if you think about it, that kind of behavior of that person, whipping their phone out at the red light, that's what an addict does. That's cell phone as addiction center. That's someone, it's like doing a shot of cocaine at the traffic light, sniffing some glue, putting a bag over your mouth and sniffing some glue at the traffic light, having a shot of beer. And there was a time when people drank and drove. Now, when we say drink and drive, we mean, you know, you drank in a building somewhere and then you got in your car. But there was a time when people drove with alcohol in the car, and it's increasingly less common. We've got mature about that. Well, with a cell phone, we are highly immature. Anyway, I think, you know, cell phones are one of these things where right now our society is sort of childish about cell phones. We're all kind of hooked on them to one extent or another, and we don't get it. This person in the last week, it was disgusting. It'd be like seeing someone taking a dump on the side of the road. Or peeing. Someone just peeing in an alley, you know? They have no control of their life or themselves. And the guy peeing in the alley, I would feel sorry for him. This person whipping out their cell phone and checking it, I don't feel sorry for them in that they're taking other people's lives in their hands while they recklessly do something that doesn't matter. But I do feel sorry for them because they have no control of themselves and they foolishly, stupidly think that checking their cell phone in their car is important. It never, ever is. I was in a store shopping and I heard Taylor Swift's Trouble being broadcast through the store. And for me, I discovered country music maybe 6 or 7 years ago while working for the city. It's funny, with the city I got kind of a minor injury. Really just an old person's aches and pains, let's say. But I got to the point where I had to be on light duty for a few days. So I ended up palling up with two other people and sort of being the third wheel and just driving the vehicle. That's all I could do. Well, they said, it was a guy and the girl said, "Do you mind if we listen to country music?" I was like, "Oh, let's give it a shot." Well, most people's perceptions of country music is it's like their perceptions of a country farmer. I know farmers now. I've lived on a farm, and I've talked to farmers next door 50 times, and they paid for me to go to university, in part, and I have a much greater respect. I have fond farming stories, partly because my dad always loved farming, loved the idea of always wanted to have a farm of his own, eventually did, but also because, you know, my family, we became health conscious earlier than most other people did. And part of being health conscious is, you know, getting back to more natural means and methods. Country types, you know, we love to criticize them. These days, you know, it's a Democrat-dominated media, a left-leaning media. And the center of the country, you know, the heartland of the country is more right-leaning, right-wing, more conservative. And then what people would say, Bible-thumping, right? And yeah, some country songs have religion in them. They do, and I find it annoying, and I wish they didn't. Especially because sometimes some of the great songs have, you know, some religious words in them, and I don't accept that. That's like putting fluoride in toothpaste or putting fluoride in something that's otherwise really good. Get the fluoride out. Get the religion out. It has no place in a song. Unless you're in Sunday school, unless you've gone to church. If you've gone to church, you play whatever songs you want inside your building. I could care less. Please don't involve me. Anyway, Taylor Swift's Trouble is kind of cool. Kind of innovative. Taylor Swift, very innovative. She's spanned genres, not just country music, but also sort of the VH1 featured her songs too. So it got me to going back to some of my favorite country songs that I'd acquired and come to appreciate over the last few years, and Miranda Lambert as well. And so I got some of those tunes rolling around in my head. So that's my re-listen of the week. Taylor Swift and Miranda Lambert. Each of them has a number of hits. Take your pick. My cool thing of the week was a story. And again, this is a story where you don't need to read the details. Headline of the story: New Zealand school tries recess with no rules. Simple as that. I did the excerpt. Here's one paragraph from it. In contrast to the modern trend of helicopter parenting and safety-first playgrounds, one school in New Zealand has decided to completely do away with rules during recess playtime, to great effect. They aren't alone in this reversal, some of which can be justified by a study showing that children who injured themselves by falling from a height, they grow up to be less fearful of heights than those who weren't hurt. I grew up with a no-rules playground. My school, I wish I knew the dimensions of it, could compare it to other schools. It was one of the largest schools that I've ever seen. And it had many different soccer fields. I think it had at least three. It had giant, open, grassy areas, you know, acres and acres of just acres, probably 20 acres of grass areas, huge playground area. It had a large four square and tetherball area. And then it had like a treed area. It had like a little mini forest, 50 evergreen trees and a little stand of trees. And then inside of that, underneath that, they had a sand pit and you could do high jumping. This is at recess or lunchtime. You could do high jumping. Wow. Oh yeah, there's another field I just remembered in another part of the school, where the older kids would play football, and in the later years of this is elementary school, which in Canada is grades 1 to 7. I remember in grade 7, I remember Ricky Martin. He was such a talented kid. Boy, you could never tag that guy. I remember playing football in that area. By the way, that field was right next to a four-lane road. Busy four-lane road. You could easily throw the ball and have it go onto the road. And of course, we would then go and get it. And of course, there was no supervision. I think the number of times I ever saw a teacher on that playground was once a week or once a month. Actually, it was more than once a month. But let's say once a week you would have contact with a teacher on the playground. Wow, what a wild and woolly school that was. 1,200 kids, about 4 30-person classrooms per grade, maybe even more than that. I guess you can do the math, 1,200 kids. A jungle. There were gangs. The gangs would be like fighting each other at lunchtime. Once, I was the subject of the fight. Like, one gang sort of just beat up on me. I don't even know what caused it or anything. And then the other gang found out, and then that caused like a little gang war. And this wasn't gang in the modern sense with using knives. This was just, you know, young kids with a sense of fair play and bullies, and then the gang beating up the bullies kind of thing. I've got a dog snoring behind me. I don't know if you can hear him. Really deep snore, really deep sleep. So here's to this New Zealand school giving up the rules of recess. We need this. It's important. Kids need to play and find out stuff for themselves. Now, there should be a fallback, right? In other words, if someone is, you know, picking on another kid and doing stuff that's intolerable, there's nothing wrong, I think, with a teacher being there. Because just the teacher being there is a disincentive for kids to go too far. But yeah, if kids want to, you know, climb and fall. But nowadays, it's all legal liability, isn't it? If a teacher is out there and a kid climbs and falls, then the teacher could be liable. The only way around that? Sign a disclaimer. We understand that at this school, the teachers are not responsible. We cannot sue them, yada yada. Take that approach. Kids need to find out stuff for themselves. We taught our kids how to climb trees. They loved it. What a liberating thing it is. We all enjoyed it. We have some great photos of us standing in a tree, all of us climbing a tree. Teach your kids to climb trees. Don't worry about it. It's common sense. And to say the least, I don't have fears of heights. I love heights. I don't like to take risks at heights. In other words, I'm always evaluating risk. And if I'm safe, I've gone out on the CN Tower. CN is the Canadian National Company, National Railways, and related industries. CP Rail is Canadian Pacific. These are the two very large companies in Canada that are into railways and trucks and communication. CN built the tower, 1,800 foot tower in Toronto, Canada. I went there for a sales conference, and I was booked up with another guy in a hotel room. We were sharing a hotel room, and another salesman, and he said, "I suppose you want to see the CN Tower?" And I said, "You bet, let's go." We went and saw it. You ride an elevator up to about 1,000 foot level. It's glass facing. You take off out of this building, and suddenly it's just a piece of glass between you and the world as you whiz upward. Very exciting. You get up to 1,000 feet, there's like an observation deck, and then there's like views of the city, nothing but glass inside. You can learn stuff about the city, but then you can go outside and you can walk around and feel the fresh air at 1,000 feet and look out at the city. And then there was like a second stage. The first one might have been, I don't remember that it's exactly, 600 or 700 feet, and the second one might have been the 1,100 feet. There's a second elevator if you want, and you can take it. And when you go up there, there's not really an observation deck. When you get up there, you're only outside. So I've been at 1,100 feet up. There was like a little, think of it like a circular sidewalk that you could walk around this tower. There were bars. So as you looked out, there weren't vertical bars. There were bars that were at about a 20 degree angle, meaning that you would have to reach over the railing. And if you did, you could just reach the bars reaching down. And the bars started off close together at the bottom, so let's say 6 inches apart. But as these bars extended up, think of it maybe like a grill, like a catcher's mask somewhat, only the catcher's mask, imagine it being tipped down, so the bars are extending away from you. Well, as you got near the top, the gap between the bars was enough for a person to go through. So in other words, all you had to do was hop over the railing, you're now on the bars, and then you could just pull yourself up the side of these bars and you could fit through, if that's what you wanted to do. Yeah, it was accessible. So the point is that when you're leaning out and you're looking over it, you're looking straight down 1,100 feet, no glass. Just you and the Toronto skyline. It was awesome. It was unforgettable. And it was safe. You had bars and you had a railing. You were double safe. Great experience. So, let your kids do stuff. That's the cool thing of the week. I'm going to finish up with a quote. This is from Ted Turner. Ted Turner, I think he owns Turner Broadcasting, which they're into a lot of things. I think they own CNN, I think they own AMC, various TV channels. He's big, billionaire type guy. I don't know if he was serious or trying to be funny, or he said something just being honest and he realized it was funny kind of thing. Here's the quote. "If only I had a little humility, I'd be perfect." It's one of those delicious little quotes that I send out in my publication called Q9, Quotes, Thoughts, and Inspiration. I've sent it out for 16, 17 years. I've lost track of how long I've been sending it out for, something like that. I sent out about 30,000 quotes. It's free. 9 quotes a day, 5 days a week. The idea being quotes that, you know, get you through your workday. What do I like about this quote? Well, let's look at Ted's name. First of all, for someone to say this quote, they have to be a little bit audacious. So the audacious qualities are like the 5 and maybe a 5-7-3. The 3 being expressive, twinkle in their eye, or 5-6-2, the 2 with the 5, they sort of lack discretion a little bit. Well, Ted, 5-6-2. So you can see that this was the kind of remark that a Ted could make. Let it slip out. Now let's look for some of the 8 quality, because the quality that has trouble with humility is the 8 quality. So Ted Turner, 876. Well, there's the 8. I can tell you, if someone has Turner for last name, they can be probably at times a little arrogant, a little lacking in humility. What's his total? Ted Turner, 448. 8 destiny. If you had to sum Ted Turner up with one number, it'd be the 8 quality. And for myself, being an 8, I was an 808. I had a 628 first name, still do. 8 destiny. I have a lot of 8. I can understand the 8 quality. It all fits. It fits with the companies, the way he runs them. He's successful. People don't like him. They perceive it as arrogance or lack of humility. Maybe he was making a joke that he was summing up other people's feelings about himself, and he could laugh at himself. But there's a positive side to that 8, and that is that they have confidence. And confidence and humility, it's kind of like that balance, right? It's like right now my stomach's gurgling, I can hear it. And so gurgling and whatnot means you're hungry. On the other hand, you can eat too much. And we got to live that balance, that food balance, our whole life. Imagine. We have a car that needs gas 3 times a day, every day, for 80 years. That's a lot of gas. And we have to balance it, right? The body is designed to store food in fat times to get through the lean times, right? Well, with our modern lifestyle, we don't have lean times. And so we tend towards too much storage. So with Mr. Turner here, you can be humble on the one hand, but then you got to promote yourself on the other hand. You can be humble and go, there's things I don't know on the one hand, but then the 8 has a very strong sense of knowing, more than any other number. With other numbers, they think stuff, they wonder stuff, they ponder stuff, they are unsure about stuff, they have a simple view of stuff. The 8 has a sense of knowing, very strong sense of knowing, and it can be perceived as arrogance. Don't let someone who appears to be arrogant, don't let that get in the way of you learning potentially from them. Like in my case, I just have always had a lot of the 8 quality, a lot. And then it turned out my dad had a prominent, strong 8-ish quality. He wasn't 8-ish, but he was confident and competent like the 8 quality. And he had a way of presenting himself that was, despite dressing like a vagabond, he never was into dress. He had a way of presenting himself like the 8 quality. So the trick is to learn something from each number and also to be able to see past what doesn't matter. Whether someone is humble or arrogant doesn't matter. What matters is, what are they saying? What is the truth content? Yeah, if you see a pattern over time, if, you know, every time you meet them, they only want to talk about themselves and how great they are, well, that gets old in about the second time around, and you don't have to put up with that. But in the context of this quote, if only I had a little humility, I'd be perfect. That's a clever quote. It's a thoughtful quote. And it's only, what, 10 words? It's just a snapshot into the mind of Ted Turner. It doesn't say everything about him. Don't judge him just on this. Give him this one as being a creative, fun, thought-provoking quote. And remain open. Maybe you can learn from him. This has been Floyd Maxwell, JustThinkIt.com, doing the Floydcast number 18 for June 16, 2014. I'm about to start watching golf, final round, U.S. Open. The Heat are going to be playing later on today. And my man, Lionel Messi, playing for Argentina in the World Cup of Soccer later on today. So I got a great sports day looking forward to. I hope you have a good day and a good week. Good luck with your life. Take care.